Up next, a very, very, very old brain. Imagine it's 300 million years ago. Much more of the Earth is covered in water. And the Midwestern United States actually has a prehistoric ocean sitting right there. If you live at the Midwest, you know all about it. And there's a strange fish that swims by. It's small enough to fit into your palm with huge eyes. It has a clubbed tail. And now fast forward to today. The fish's dusty skull is sitting in a museum drawer. Like a lot of fossils, they wind up in these drawers. But a scientist roots it out for study, and he scans it with x-rays and discovers there's something inside that brain case. There's a mass in there. And he runs more tests and confirms that the mass is, it's the oldest fossilized brain ever found. This is a true story, and to tell us more about it is my guest, Dr. John Macy. He's the curator in the Division of Paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History, and he worked on the study with Alan Pradel, the graduate student in Paris who discovered the brain. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Macy.
Yes, hello. Thank you.
Is this exactly how it happened, just by accident?
Exactly so. By accident, Alan Pradel was actually, as part of his PhD thesis research, was studying these fossilized brain cases from Kansas. And when he scanned one of them with a CT scanner and he was looking at the sections, he noticed this very odd-looking blob right in the middle of some of the slices, and it was a symmetrical shape. So we looked at it all, we tried to reconstruct it, and it began to look more and more like a brain. And so he sent the specimen off to be scanned again, this time at a synchrotron facility, the European synchrotron in Grenoble in France. And sure enough, when the higher resolution scan came back, we had beautiful renderings of this little brain inside the brain case.
And exactly where did it come from?
Well, it came from, the fossil originally came from Kansas, from rocks that are somewhere not too far from Lawrence. And it was collected many years ago, along with a lot of other fossils from the same place, and many of them just lay around in the collection for years, not being studied. The fossils themselves don't look like very much, and that's the problem. So nobody paid much attention to them until Alan really got into his research.
Mm-hmm. So there probably are not a lot of these kinds of scans around. Very much brain fossils are lying around someplace.
Well, this has raised an interesting question, because it's possible that there are brains fossilized in other things, and nobody's ever really bothered to look or been able to look. It's really a question of technology.
So you don't just take a fish fossil and shake it and see if there's a brain.
Well, they don't usually rattle around like that, no.
But brains are
pretty remarkable tissue when you think about it. The brain tissue is mostly water anyway.
Right.
And so to preserve anything is a pretty remarkable situation.
Yeah, so this is a rare, rare find now.
I think it is. We're going to try and find more, but, the odds are stacked against us. This is not only the oldest brain, but the little bit of research I've been able to do suggests it may very well be the only one from this kind of fossils of this age.
So was there a rare circumstance of the water and the mud and everything around this fish that fossilized the brain?
Yes, I think so. We've been debating just how something like that could preserve. We know from other fossils, especially fossil fishes, that you can preserve soft tissue. Quite often you find fossilized muscle and part of the gut, the intestine, the stomach, and even parts of the gills. But these are all tissues that are associated with the body cavity. And it's quite possible that in the process of rapid burial and decomposition, where some kind of bacteria are producing phosphate from the animal, and then this phosphate mineral mm-hmm. is getting into these soft tissues. But how it got into the brain, now that's a whole other issue.
Right. So what can you learn from this brain?
We learned that, first of all, the brain structure, the overall structure, is remarkably similar to that of a modern shark or a chimeroid. These are the fishes this thing is supposed to be related to. And that's not surprising, perhaps, but at least it's an important confirmation of what we would expect to see in a modern shark or something like that. The brain itself has very large optic lobes. That's the part of the brain responsible for vision and for perception of sight. And in addition, you know, the fossil itself shows these very large orbits for very large eyeballs, and that's kind of confirms that the vision was an important aspect of this animal's way of life. Whatever it did, it used its eyes a lot to get its prey or to see where it was going and so forth. Mm-hmm. And perhaps it was even nocturnal. Of course, we're guessing now, but you know, fishes with very large eyes quite often are nocturnal.
Mm-hmm. And are paleontologists and museum curators around the world now opening up those dusty drawers and pulling out the old fossils that they may want to scan?
Well, we certainly are in New York, and I know that Alan intends to go back and look through the Kansas collections and other collections. We found very similar fossils in other parts of North America. We find them, for example, in Kentucky, Oklahoma, Texas, and so on. And the fossils are not uncommon. They're difficult to study.
Yeah.
And so we're hoping that among all the things, you know, if we can identify particular candidates for scanning, we should be able to see if there's anything inside them.
So the scanner then is like a new tool that you have that you never
had before. It really is. I mean, in a way, it's kind of like, you know, a paleontological Hubble telescope, because it allows us to see inside things that we couldn't previously do without very destructive preparation. And that's the one real beauty of CT and synchrotron scanning, is that it's non-destructive, it's non-invasive, and very often these fossils are extremely rare, especially fossil sharks. And you know, early shark-like fossils where we can actually see more than just their teeth are really rare. And so the ability to study them in some detail and see internal structures is really, really good.
Hmm. We're talking about Ineapterygian this hour on Science Friday from NPR News, talking with John Macy about this 300-million-year-old fish and the scanning of the skulls and the fact that the scanner is now a really – it's interesting how you phrase that. It's the Hubble telescope of your trade.
Yes, it really is, because you know, CT scanning, obviously the technology has been around for a while, but the high energy and high resolution scanners that are being used today are relatively new, and scanning has really caught on in paleontology in about the last 10 years. Now, a number of people have been scanning their fossils using CT scanners and getting some excellent results. Mm-hmm. It's a two-part process. First, you need to get the scans. You need a powerful X-ray source to get through the rock. And then once you've got your scan, then you need a pretty sophisticated computer and computer software to analyze mm-hmm. the data and to isolate the structures, and so you can see what you've got.
Can you give us an idea of what the scan told you about this creature itself, its behavior, what it was like in the water?
Well, you know, I always say behavior doesn't fossilize. It's a very hard thing to track. But the fossil shows us, for example, apart from the fact that we've got these very large eyes and the optic lobes of the brain are well developed, in addition, there's some very strange features of the ear region. And that is a puzzle, because we don't have a modern paradigm, a modern example with quite the same arrangement. What you have in the inner ear in this Ineapterygian, you have the three semicircular canals as we have and as other vertebrates have, mm-hmm. Jawed vertebrates, I should say, and the horizontal canal is quite normal. But the vertical canals, the one at the front and the back, the anterior and posterior canals, are extremely short and attenuated. And that implies that this fish had a remarkably good, you know, sense of horizontal movement and acceleration. So if it swung from side to side as it was swimming, it would have a pretty good idea what it was doing. But vertical movement up and down, or from side to side like a roll, means that the ear region probably wasn't picking up a very, very accurate signal. So this fish must have had a rather bizarre sense of orientation.
So it didn't know up from down? It didn't know
it,
how?
It probably, you know, I mean, that's, yes, the bottom line is it was probably somewhat limited in what it could detect up and down. It could detect sideways just great. But going up and down and rolling from side to side, now why it would do that is a puzzle, because, of course, you know, these senses, especially in a fish, very important.
Yeah. It sounded like it was good food for another fish in that case.
That, in fact, may be the case, because these things are preserved in little round phosphate nodules. And one possibility is that these nodules actually came from the intestines of something even bigger.
Wow.
So it was that
time of the year. I mean, in evolutionary speaking, that for bigger fish to be around.
That's right. Yes, indeed.
Wow. Thank you very much. It's quite fascinating. Thank you very much, Dr. Macy.
You're very welcome. Thanks for your interest.
You're welcome. Dr. John Macy is curator in the Division of Paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. That's about all the time we have for this week. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Kim Ileski. If you have comments or questions, or if you missed any of the stuff we talked about, you're more than welcome to surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're podcasting. The podcast will be up there just as soon as we can get it up there. And you can join a weekly podcast. Also, video podcasts are up there. Our Flora's pick of the week. Our great video of a robot that does so well in the sand today. You want to see our sandbot. Also, we're Twittering. We'd love to have our Twitters. We're getting close to 10,000 Twitter members. We're trying to get that number up there, so help us join our Twitter at SciFry and also in Second Life. Have a great weekend. Don't forget to spring forward. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.